Vincent Price and Wally Meyer and Ted DeCorsica, along with Escape regular Paul Fries, are in South America tonight, where they've hit a big uranium strike. It does sound like an escape plot already. And the three of them, we find, have an unusual approach to splitting up the proceeds. Suffice it to say that it involves certain obstacles. Piranha, vampire bats, electric eels, and that most treacherous of all, man. The name of our tale is Bloodbath, and it's Escape from June 30th, 1950.
Tired of the everyday routine? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape! Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
It's time to escape with an exciting story of men and women whose dramatic lives will carry you beyond the horizons of the ordinary scene to a fascinating world of secret enterprise, strange experience, unforgettable adventure. The charmed world of Escape.
Tonight, we escape to the jungles of South America and a seething tale of terror and violence as told by James Poe in Bloodbath, starring Mr. Vincent Price.
By portaging the rapids and walking the mules in the shallower stretches, we'd managed to get our supplies and equipment more than 1,700 miles up the river. After this, further navigable passage being impossible, we'd traveled by foot, hacking our way through the thick, steaming jungle, coaxing and goading the heavily laden beasts. We'd left the jungle and begun the climb. 11 days later, high in the Andes, we found our objective, and we set to work, hard work. And then, on a hazy afternoon in late May, we found it. I shall never forget the scene. Below us, the mountains swung down to the jungle, which stretched eastward, far as the eye could see. The peaks above us had cut off the setting sun, and the light had a curious violet quality. The dank, chill wind, whispering and gusting, set the sparse timber scrubs to trembling and shuddering, and the mules, disdainful of their five strange masters, foraged the cacti and dwarf pine. The instruments were set up, and the specimens were at hand, and now, crouched and tense, we leaned forward.
How about it, Hess?
Wait. The tube's got to warm up. Come on, come on.
Wait, will you?
I've waited 5 years for this moment.
500, you mean? 5 million? Come on, Hessie.
How about it, Hess?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Give him the sample, O'Brien.
Yeah, here.
Come on, baby.
Shut up, will you?
Shh.
Here goes. Switch on. Holy cow. Good. Good. It's fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, Hessie. What's the word?
Yeah, Hessie. Give.
Gentlemen. Gentlemen. Unless this machine is busted, unless this Geiger counter has forgotten its multiplication table, we have discovered the richest load of uranium ore known to man.
I won't go into the details of how we'd come to locate the ore, because that's a story in itself. Suffice it to say that late in the afternoon of that hazy May day, the five of us, gamblers all, came to the end of our rainbow, found our pot of gold.
The vein runs all the way up the side of the mountain.
Must be worth $1 million.
A million, a billion.
$1 trillion. Do you boys realize what we've got here?
Sure we do.
We've got the world at our feet. Why, the man who gets the strike registered in his name can be a king. Every country in the world is going to come running up to him with trunks full of money and power.
Ha! You tell him, Hesse.
Power?
Yeah, we'll make the United States the most powerful nation on earth.
Why the United States?
Oh, you wouldn't sell to anybody else, would you?
I'm a businessman, Harris.
You're a fool.
No, no. I'm a businessman.
$1 trillion.
Oh, gents, we've got the world at our feet.
Split five ways.
The world at our feet. Split five ways. That night, as I lay huddled under my thin blanket, I wondered what it would be like being a wealthy man. Wondered if it were really true. Wondered how it would affect the others, how it would affect me. In the morning, we were to set off on the long return journey down to the jungle and through the jungle to the launch and down the river to civilization. There, we'd register our claim, purchase, if need be, the land, lease it perhaps from the government.
Oh, millionaires. World at our feet. Uranium. Enough to blow up the whole universe. Power.
Harris, wake up.
Wake up, Harris. Oh, good morning, millionaire.
Weems, wake up.
Sun's coming up. Hey. Hey, where are the others?
They've gone.
Huh? Gone?
Yes, Dumont and O'Brien. They took the mules and most of the food and cut out.
When?
How do I know when? Sometime during the night.
But why?
Why? $1 trillion, that's why.
Oh, no, no, no.
Once they get down to the jungle, they'll have to travel on foot. There's 10 days' march to the river. If they beat us to the boat, we're stuck with 1,500 miles of jungle between us and safety.
50? Impossible. We'd never make 100.
That's right. We've got to catch them or we're dead.
Traveled as lightly as possible. It was a risky business, doubly so because O'Brien and Dumont had taken our guns with them. The only weapons we had between us were one long machete and two pocket knives. These would be of little protection against jaguars, bushmasters, tapirs, boa constrictors, and the rest of it. Fortunately, they'd left our number one necessity to survival. They'd forgotten to take our quinine. This and our food was all we carried. The long descent to the jungle was slow going on foot. It was here that we nearly gave up hope. We moved as fast as we could, but we were no match for men who were riding. But we reached the jungle. Then things took a better turn. Here the thick vines and heavy undergrowth was, we knew, almost an impossible hazard for a riding man. And we could see their boot prints mingled with those of the mules. We knew that they were having trouble, too. The animals were afraid of many things in the jungle. Would balk suddenly require careful handling? We pushed ahead as rapidly as possible, battling mosquitoes, pium flies, motucas, and the blood-sucking carpato ticks, and, of course, the jungle itself with its never-ending barrage of razor grasses, needle vines, swamps, bog traps, and so forth. It was hot, stinking hot, and the going was hard, but we had to make it. We couldn't travel at night. They'd taken our flashlights. We'd bundle up as best we could, protecting ourselves, not from the cold, it was hot and muggy even at dawn, but from the mosquitoes. And as we progressed towards the river area, from the bats. Vampire bats. Ever seen them? They're small, rather fragile-looking little things. By day, they hang, heads down from the trees, wings folded like clusters of rotten fruit. By night, they hunt. They have razor-sharp teeth, bite like the finest steel scalpels. Their object is to break the skin very delicately, start the blood to coming, and then they simply hang on and sit. Without mosquito netting, we had a rough time of it, a sleepless time. But we managed to keep on going. And on the third day...
It's no use, fellas. We can't make it to the river before them.
We've got to, Weensy. We've got to make it.
He's right, Weensy.
And even if we do catch up, they got the guns.
Shh, shh.
Huh? What are you stopping?
Oh, quiet, quiet. I heard something.
What did you hear?
Shh. Gunfire.
Yeah. Come on. They can't be more than a mile or two ahead. Come on.
We ran through the jungle, following the fresh marks of the animals and the two men. And a half an hour or so later, we broke into a little clearing, and there was Dumont.
Dumont.
He's dead.
Shot in the back.
Good old Obie.
Sweet guy, that Obie.
Here, come on.
Let's turn him over. He's really been sweating, huh?
Yeah.
It's malaria. You see his face?
Good old Obie.
And Dumont came down with malaria, probably started to slow him down.
Sweet guy, that Obie.
Come on. Come on, let's go.
Hey, they should have remembered the quinine.
I got no sympathy for Dumont.
You know what would be nice?
What?
If that Obie should get malaria now.
Yeah. He'd be helpless.
He'd ask me for quinine. And I'd throw him a stone.
On we went. Now there were no boot marks with the mule tracks. Apparently O'Brien was riding one of the animals. From time to time, we'd see a flurry of tracks churned up as though he had had to dismount to tug one of the beasts back onto the trail. We followed the tracks for another 2 days, and then on the sixth day, we found one of the mules.
How you feeling, boy? Huh? Where's your saddle?
He really looks beat. Look at those marks on his flanks.
Vampire bats.
Yeah.
That leaves O'Brien on foot.
Yeah.
Hey, you hear that?
Hey, it's the launch. We're to the river.
He's starting the motor. Come on.
It wasn't very far, just a few hundred yards. And the path was strewn with O'Brien's discarded supplies. Quite suddenly, we came out of the jungle and onto a narrow white sandbar. The river. And there, not 30 feet away from us, just drifting off into the deep, dark, fast-moving waters, was O'Brien and the launch. O'Brien!
Beat you! I beat you!
Look at him. He's like a skeleton.
Obie! Wait for us, Obie!
The launch lurched dizzily as it floated downstream. O'Brien was feeble, sweating, possessed. He had the fever, had it bad.
Come on, let's go after
him. You can't. This is piranha water.
Cannibal fish, they'll eat you, Hesse.
Yeah.
Hey, Obie! Hey, you know me, Obie! Your old pal, Hesse! Hey, what do you say, Obie, huh?
He staggered dizzily about the cockpit, trying to start the engine. He was laughing, and he was so weak that he could barely spin the flywheel to the kicker.
Obie!
He slipped!
Good Lord, he's in the water!
The fish, the piranhas!
Oh, they got him, they got him!
I ain't gonna look at this!
One moment we saw him swimming weakly, his large, fever-ridden eyes turned imploringly toward us, and the next moment he was gone, leaving only a large, red, churning patch on the water. The piranhas are small, rarely more than 12 or 14 inches long, small fish with large, powerful jaws, teeth like broken glass, and an insatiable, maniacal appetite for flesh. The launch, caught by the deep, fast-moving waters, rocked softly this way and that and moved on downstream. Away. Away around a bend and out of sight.
Stretching the good old dollar is something all of us think a lot about these days. We like to make it go as far as we can. You'd be surprised at how much stretching care can do with a dollar, how far care can make it go, and how much food it can buy and put into the hands of hungry people in Europe and Asia who need food to supplement their present diets. CARE's thrift package is one for you to stretch your dollars all the way across the seas to help a person or a family in need. CARE's thrift package is only $5.50, delivery guaranteed. You couldn't duplicate it for under $7.25. Send a Care Thrift food package today to your relatives or to your relatives or friends in Europe. Or send a Care Thrift package designated for a needy family. Stretch your dollar. Order today from Care Los Angeles. That's C-A-R-E, Care.
And now we return you to Escape, starring Vincent Price.
We picked over the supplies O'Brien had left on the shore. There wasn't much we wanted. A gun without ammunition, a few tins of food, a tent and some bedding, cooking equipment, a coil of rope. We loaded these things onto the mule and set off through the jungle, downstream along the river's course. 1,500 miles to civilization. We had it tough. The jungle was thick along the river's bank, and we made little progress. Not more than 5 miles that day, but the next day, we rounded a bend, keeping close to the shore, and there, about a quarter mile below us and nuzzling the opposite shore, grounded on the sand, lay the launch.
Looks shallow enough here.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, but what about the fish?
How deep does it look to you, Harris, with the deepest spot, I mean?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 2.5 feet, maybe 3.
Most of it's less than that.
I got an idea.
Shoot.
We got to get across the launch, see? Yeah. So here's what we do. We throw away everything. There'll be food and water in the launch, see?
Yeah.
Now, you see that little patch of sand in the middle of the river where the bar shows?
Yeah.
We go that way. That's bound to be the shallowest way, see?
How do we go?
On the mule, the three of us.
Ah, you're nuts.
This mule ain't in such bad condition it can't get the three of us across 70 feet of shallow water.
What do you say, Harris?
Why not?
All right, I'll get aboard first. Come on.
Get farther up, Weemsy. You're the lightest.
Yeah.
Harris, you get on next. Hang on to Weemsy. Here. Carry this coil of rope around your neck. We may need it. I've got the machete strapped to my back.
Hey, you set, Weems?
Yeah.
Now hold tight to me, Hess.
Don't worry. If I go, you go too.
Yeah, and if he goes, I go.
So let's hang on, gents. Yeah. Let's really hang on.
As long as he's moving fast, he can't get at his legs. Ain't that right?
He's not showing anything to him but hoofs and hair.
Hold his head up, Weems. Don't let him look down.
You all set?
Yeah,
all set.
All right, here we go. All right, get along. Come on.
Come on, baby.
I felt the mule lurch when he stepped into the water. The sand was softer here than on the shore.
Sand, huh?
Ahead, not 40 feet away, lay the little spit of land. The mule refused to run, couldn't run, and before he'd taken 10 steps, I knew he was too weak to support the three of us. From every direction in the swirling water about us came small, shadowy, dark shapes.
Come on.
The piranhas.
Don't stop. Come on, baby. Keep moving, baby. Come on. Move along, baby.
He can't do it.
You gotta do it, baby.
Come on.
Sweet mother. What are those?
The piranhas were churning the water about us, and coming in from beyond them were 4 or 5 long, dark shapes, 6 and 7 feet long, thick and wriggling.
Eels, electric eels.
They'll sting them. Get along to the bar.
Get into the sandbar.
Faster. Come on.
Made it.
It's true about electric eels. They can throw a jolt that'll kill a jaguar. They got jaws like a vice.
So, here we are, gentlemen, stuck. Just 30 feet of water between us and the shore. Get across it, and we can get to the launch and the civilization and all the rest.
Oh, the three of us are too much for that mule.
Only 30 feet. Why, you could run it in seconds.
You see those little shadows around us in the water?
I see those little shadows around us. You don't have to draw pictures.
Hey.
Oh, here's another bright idea coming up.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah, hold on to your hat, Harris.
We got that coil of rope.
Yes.
The mule could carry one of us. That mule's not in such bad shape, you know.
Yes.
Tie the rope over his bridle. Then one of us pulls him over with him fast, you see. One rides, and then the other two pull him back.
Yeah.
And the next one gets on.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Oh, I can't stay here.
It's a natural.
Who goes first?
Me, on account I'm the lightest. I won't tire him so much.
How about it, Harris?
All right.
Well, get going then.
Okay. Tie that rope to his bridle.
I'm doing it.
All right, give me the machete.
What do you want the machete for?
I want it, that's all. Give me.
No. Okay.
All right, here. Now you two get at the end of the spit. So as when you pay out the line, you don't get it caught in his legs.
Well, you think of everything.
That's right, I'm a smart boy.
Ready with the line.
You sure it's tied fast to the bridle?
Yeah, I'm sure.
No funny business, Weems. All we gotta do is jerk this rope once while you're over that water and you're done for.
You're a sharp article.
Yeah, that's right.
But not sharp enough.
Hey,
Weems, you cut the rope.
So long, sucker.
The rope, our only salvation, was cut. And now Weems, grinning and riding, was out into the stream, heading for the shore and safety. He went not 15 feet when one of the long, dark, wriggling shapes made for the mule and got his leg. The mule reared up on his hind legs, the eel clinging to his foot, pumping paralyzing shocks into him. Weems clutched his neck with one hand and slapped him on the flank with the flat of the machete with the other. The mule came down and more eels went for his legs. He began to lurch sideways. Weems swung the long steel blade in an arc, barely missing the mule's leg, and connected with one of the eels. Hair seemed to stand on end. His other arm released the mule's neck. The arm holding the blade was extended stiffly, still caught in the thick, muscular back of the electric eel. And then the mule reared again, and Weems fell back into the water. The mule, freed of Weems, made the shore and vanished into the jungle. We turned away. No man could watch what was happening to Weems and retain his sanity. And so, there we were. Hess and I on that sand spit which the river was slowly washing away. Night coming, vampire bats coming, and all about us, the electric eels and the little cannibal fish waiting. There was no moon. There were evil stars, red and yellow. It was a black sky, and against it, blacker shapes, the vampire bats. We waved our arms and kept them off, but again and again during that long and terrible night, they brushed against us, squealing and squeaking, trying to get us. Dark, evil, thirsting bats. A thousand years later came the dawn.
That water's taken a lot of sand away. This thing isn't much bigger than a card table. Look at them. Look at those fish. You think they had enough to eat yesterday. Listen, Harris. No matter what happens now, at least you and I have played it square, right?
Yeah, that's right, Harris.
Shake my hand, Harris.
All right.
Because I think I got an idea on how we can get out of here.
What?
Yeah. Look up there.
Yeah.
See that vine hanging down from the big tree?
It's over the water, and it must be 15 feet up.
Yeah, but if you were on it, you could do a tarzan to the shore.
The rope?
That's right. Now, if we can just lasso the end of that and pull tight, we'll have enough swing to make it across. Swing like a pendulum, if you follow me. One guy gets on the other's shoulders to swing over to get the start, see? Then, when he gets to shore, he fastens a rock and swings the rope back to the other.
That vine will hold. It'll work. It took us 2 hours before we managed to lasso the end of that vine. And then we tested it again and again until we were positive it would hold a man's weight. And then we were ready.
You stand good and steady now, pal. I'm going to go easy on you, but don't shake. Because if you spill me in that water, I'm a gone guy.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
Good luck.
Here.
No!
I felt his feet leave my shoulders, and then he was off, skimming the water with his feet drawn up, and then, miraculously, he was on the shore.
Good boy! Good boy!
Yeah!
Like a breeze, huh?
Like a breeze.
Hey, any rocks around there?
Sorry.
He smiled at me and shrugged and then looked down the stream at the launch. I knew that smile, that trillion-dollar smile. It said, so long, sucker. Don't do it, Hess. Send me the rope.
You're too nice a guy, Harris. You and I would never get along.
You can have it all, Hess, every scrap of it. Only for the love of mercy, send me the rope.
No, you'd want some. You wouldn't approve of what I mean to do with it.
Hess!
He stood there laughing at me and shaking his head slowly. But above him, just over his head, was another vine, thick and mottled, and it was moving. Look out, Hess! Hess! He didn't understand or didn't hear me. Just stood there smiling and shaking his head. The boa constrictor dropped heavily and accurately, a thrashing tangle of scaly muscle.
The sun was hot, blistering hot. I was alone, all alone, except for the ever-waiting piranhas. Hess's body was hidden by the low, scrubby vines and palmettos. Several hours later, I saw the boa, now gorged, slither lumpily away. I waited, and I waited. From time to time, I thought of stepping out into the stream. It would be over very quickly, I told myself, very quickly. But I couldn't. And then I noticed an odd thing. The current which had been sweeping the sand away had shifted slightly. A whim, a miracle. And now new sand from some sunken bar was beginning to pile up between me and the shore, grain by grain, rib by rib. I watched this. And I watched. And I watched. And it 5 o'clock that afternoon, I walked ashore to the lodge and didn't even get my feet wet. It's nice where I live. Quiet little streets, nice people, nice kids, nice country. Peaceful. Nice peace. I know where there's enough uranium to blow it all to hell. Want it? Just go up the river. Up the river, it's for the taking. Ask Dumont and Obi and Weems and Hess. $1 trillion worth. Enough to give the whole world a bloodbath. Yourself included.
You may be one of those who have had the urge to help feed a hungry child or family overseas, but felt your budget wouldn't permit sending a $10 CARE standard food package. CARE's thrift package at only $5.50, delivery guaranteed, is designed to ease the strain on your budget and at the same time gives you an opportunity to help. The CARE thrift package is a welcome addition to the drab, monotonous austerity diet prevalent in Europe today. If you tried to buy, pack, and ship a package like this yourself, it would cost you more than $7.25. CARE does the whole job for you for only $5.50. Here is your chance to send a CARE package inexpensively. It's your opportunity to help that needy family in Europe and not endanger your own budget. You can order CARE's thrift food package today through CARE, Los Angeles. C-A-R-E, CARE, Los Angeles.
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and tonight starred Mr. Vincent Price. Bloodbath was written by James Poe. Others in the cast were Wally Mayer, Ted DeCorsia, Paul Frees, and Tony Barrett. Special music arranged and played by Ivan Dittmars. Next week.
You are groping your way slowly through the dark hold of a ship at sea, moving carefully, step by step, dreading to find what you know is there. Death in the form of a deadly bushmaster from which there is no escape.
Next week at this time, CBS invites you to escape to the Caribbean and a grim voyage of impending death, as Martin Storm tells it in his exciting tale, A Shipment of Mute Fate. Goodbye, then, until this same time next week, when once again we offer you Escape. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
KNX Columbia Square, Los Angeles.
Wow, doesn't get much better than that. A grim voyage of death and a shipment of mute fate. We will hear that episode again one of these days. We heard it many moons ago. Tonight, it was Escape with Bloodbath from June 30th, 1950. Vincent Price doing the narration and providing one of the leads in that story of a big and very deadly uranium strike. Next Sunday night, between 8 and 11, we'll have a visit to Fort Laramie from 1956. We'll have the Great Gildersleeve from 1952 and a story about trying to get better acquainted with someone who doesn't really want to be better acquainted in a department store. Philip Marlowe has a case called The Key Man next Sunday night. We'll have CBS Radio Workshop with something very unusual called Meditation on Ecclesiastes that features Edward R. Murrow and Senator John F. Kennedy, a broadcast from 1957. Also from 1957, next Sunday night, X-1, with a light piece called The Category Inventor. We'll have an appearance from Bob and Ray next Sunday, too, and also Strange Wills with Treasure to Starboard. Yet to come this Sunday night, a visit to the Hall of Fantasy, as old-time radio drama continues right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight, as we enter the Hall of Fantasy, we're likely to ask, what is it that's odd about Simeon Botar other than that hand of his? And how does he play chess blindfolded? Our story is called The Hand of Botar. It comes to us from June 3rd, 1953, from the Hall of Fantasy.
And now, the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Hand of Botar.
Uncle Simeon, are you all right?
He's dead.
What?
He's dead. I went out to make a telephone call. There's no extension in here, you know. I was dialing the number when I thought I heard Simeon say something. And then I heard him scream. I ran back in here and found him like this.
Look.
Where?
At his throat. There are 5 red marks on his throat, like finger marks. Just as if he'd been choked to death by a person using only one hand.
The Hall of Fantasy will present The Hand of Botar in just a moment. And now for our story entitled The Hand of Botar.
Even after he was dead, the spirit of Simeon Botar remained with those who had known him. His personality was so strong that when he entered a room, all eyes were immediately drawn to him. But there was something strange about Simeon, something different that set him apart from other men. It couldn't be defined, but it was there just the same. And when he said,
"Even when I die, the world will not forgive me. I'll make sure of that. Even if I have to return from death."
I first met Simeon Botar several months ago. Eric Matreau had insisted that I meet him, and so one evening we drove out to his small estate several miles from town.
You like Simeon, Charles. He's a very interesting person.
Well, I certainly hope so. The way you talk about him, he seems to be an idol of yours.
Well, hardly that. It's just that I find him stimulating. And when I told him that you played a wonderful game of chess, he insisted that I bring you out.
He's a chess player, eh?
Oh, yes, a very fine one. When you play with him tonight,
you'll be treated to a very unusual experience.
How do you mean?
You'll see for yourself. You know, Charles, there's something odd about Simeon. I can't place it myself. Maybe you'll be able to help me.
Something odd about him?
Yes, and even though he's so interesting a person, there's something about him that frightens me. Almost as if there was an air of death about him. Especially about that hand of his.
I didn't know whether Eric was trying to play some kind of a joke on me or not. I had no time to think about it, however, as in a minute we turned off the highway onto the gravel road leading up to the house. The door of Botar's house was opened for us by a very beautiful young woman.
Oh, it's so good to see you, Eric.
Thank you, Marcia. My good friend, Charles Brakely. Marcia Jameson, Simeon's niece.
A pleasure.
Won't you come in?
Where is Simeon, Marcia?
He's in the living room waiting for you. I understand you're quite a chess player, Mr. Brakely.
Well, not a very good one, I'm afraid.
Oh, on the contrary. Eric says that you're an excellent player. And Uncle Simeon is most anxious to meet you. It's right in here.
Simeon, say we're here.
Oh, so good of you to come, Eric. As I take it, it's Mr. Brakely?
Yes.
Well, I'm very pleased to make your acquaintance. Would you gentlemen care for a drink?
Oh, none for me, thank you.
The usual for me.
Marcia, will you prepare a drink for Eric?
Yes, Uncle Simeon.
You play chess, eh, Mr. Brakely?
Yes.
Then sit down, please. As you can see, I already have prepared the board for play. Seeing you're my guest, you may have the white, Mr. Brakely.
Oh, thank you.
Would you put on the blindfold for me, Eric?
Well, of course, of course. Tighten up, Simeon?
Yes. Can't see a thing. Thank you, Eric.
I hope you don't expect
Not at all,
me
Mr. Brakely. Not at all.
Here's your drink, Eric.
Thank you.
Are you ready, Mr. Brakely?
Do you want me to call out my moves to you?
Oh, no. That won't be necessary.
Well, then, how do you know what move I make?
Oh, my hand will know. Proceed, Mr. Brakely. You have the opening move.
All right.
King's pawn to king four, Mr. Brakely. Good safe opening. I'll counter with the same move. Now, your move, Mr. Brakely. King's knight to king's bishop, Mr. Brakely. Let's say I'll bring my queen out thusly.
Mr. Botar, how do you know what moves I make? You can't see the board through that blindfold, can you?
Of course not, Mr. Brakely. My hand tells me.
Your what?
My hand. You notice how the fingers are drumming now, Mr. Brakely?
Yes.
But my brain is not controlling those fingers, Mr. Brakely. The hand is an entity unto itself.
Are you serious?
Of course I am. How else would I know your moves? I cannot see you, Mr. Brakely. Neither my niece nor Mr. Patrol have told me what moves you've made. How else would I know? Let us proceed, Mr. Brakely. It's your move, I believe.
The game continued. It was incredible. The fingers of his hand would be silent as he moved, but when it was my turn, he would place his hand on the table and the fingers would begin drumming slowly. As I made my move, the tempo of those beating fingers would increase and then stop as Botar made his move.
Your move, Mr. Brakely. Check, Mr. Brakely. Check. Check. Check and mate. You play a very good game, Mr. Brakely. I'll take this blindfold off now.
Oh, now, tell me the truth, Mr. Botar. How did you know my moves?
Well, I've told you the truth.
Well, you don't mean to say...
That's exactly what I mean to say. My right hand has developed to such an extent that I believe it has, well, almost an intelligence of its own.
That's impossible.
Not necessarily. If I lose the use of one hand, we learn to do things with the other that require two hands before. A blind man learns to make his other senses perform some of the duties of his eyes. It's not impossible.
The hand does seem to have an intelligence of its own.
It has a strange grayish cast to it, Simeon, as if it were dead.
Get me a pin, Marcia.
Yes, Simeon.
What are you going to do?
Strange thing, Eric. There's no feeling left in that hand. I'll show you what I mean.
What are you going to do?
Prove to you that I feel no pain if the hand itself is injured.
Here's the pin, Simeon.
Thank you. Now, watch me. There. It's in my hand, and yet I feel nothing.
Either you're telling the truth, or you've learned to control your reaction to pain.
It's the truth, believe me. I'll take it out now. There. You see? I have no feeling whatsoever of pain. That's strange.
What?
A hand is moving, and I'm not...
Simeon, get it away from your throat!
I can't move it.
Do something. Do something before it kills him.
We'll return to the tale of The Hand of Botar in just a moment. Back now to the Hall of Fantasy in the tale of The Hand of Botar.
Eric Matro and I have driven out to the home of Simeon Botar. I had been a witness and participant in the most bizarre exhibition I had ever seen. And then, after the game was over, when Botar was showing us that his hand had no feeling in it, the hand suddenly moved to his throat and began choking him.
Do something before it kills him.
Help me.
I'll get it.
I can't move it, Charlie.
Let me help you.
It's starting to...
Simeon, are you all right?
Yes, I guess so.
Oh, what happened, Botar?
I don't know. I can't explain it. All of a sudden... It's in my throat, choking me.
You're all right now?
Yes. I lost control of my hand at that moment, gentlemen. I couldn't move it away from my throat. But now... Now I can move it at will.
Have you thought of seeing a psychiatrist, Mr. Botar?
No. Why do you ask that?
Well, you've heard of schizophrenia. Split personality, haven't you?
Naturally. But let me tell you right now, Mr. Brakely... I am not suffering from schizophrenia.
Well, that's the only rational explanation for what just happened.
I don't think so.
Do you mean to say that you really think that hand has an intelligence of its own?
Yes, I do.
Then you'd better be careful, Mr. Botar. If what you believe is true, then that hand could very well kill you. We left shortly after that. As we drove into the city, my mind wouldn't forget the image of what had occurred that night. Eric?
Yeah?
How well do you know Simeon Botar?
Oh, pretty well.
Do you think he's all right?
If you're referring to his mental condition, I'd stake my life on it.
When I took psych in college, we studied split personality and some of the strange courses it takes. Automatic writing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The victim claims his hand wrote a certain message that he himself didn't. But actually, he was the victim of schizophrenia, split personality, and his other self wrote the message. Now, that's what could be wrong with Botar.
How do you explain the game of chess, then, Charles? He couldn't see anything, I know. I moved my cigarette close to his face while the game was going on. He didn't draw back even a fraction of an inch.
Well, that's true, but I still can't believe it.
You remember how the fingers drummed on the table prior to each of his moves and during each of yours? And then, just before it happened, remember how they began drumming on the table? When that happens, I have the feeling that the hand is thinking.
Then you believe it.
That it has an intelligence of its own. Yes, I'm afraid I do.
In the weeks that followed, I saw a great deal of Marcia Jameson. I saw Simeon very rarely, going out of my way to avoid him. I didn't believe what he had told me, but he made me feel uncomfortable, and there was something about him that frightened me. One night, Marcia and I had returned from a play downtown. We stood outside the house saying goodnight, and I noticed Eric's car in the driveway.
I had a wonderful evening, Charles.
Ah, so did I. Oh, Eric must be here. Here's his car.
I didn't notice it before.
Neither did I. It's in the shadows by the side of the house.
Charles.
Yes?
I'm getting worried about Uncle Simeon.
Why?
He's frightened. He doesn't sleep at night anymore.
What's bothering him?
The hand. He says that he can't go to sleep anymore without fearing what it will do to him. The only time he's rested He's when he's had one of the servants tie down the hand so he can't move.
I think he should see a doctor.
But that's what I thought, too, but he won't. I don't know why. What's that?
A scream from inside the house. Let's go.
Uncle Simeon?
Mr. Botar! Eric!
Oh, is that you?
Yes! Where's Simeon?
Come into the library, hurry!
What's the matter? Look.
Uncle Simeon! Are you all right?
He's dead.
What?
He's dead. I went out to make a telephone call. There's no extension in here, you know. I was dialing the number when I thought I heard Simeon say something, and then I heard him scream. I ran back in here, and I found him like this.
Look.
Where?
At his neck. There are 5 red marks on his throat, like finger marks. Just as if he'd been choked to death by a person using only one hand.
We called a doctor, and he in turn summoned the police. They questioned us closely, and when Eric told them the story about the hand, they laughed at him. The final verdict was death by strangulation, killer unknown. 3 days later, he was buried. Eric and I returned to the house with Marcia after the funeral. Marcia had taken the funeral very badly, and we sent her up to take a nap for a few hours. I'll get it. Hello?
May I speak to Miss Jameson, please?
Oh, she's resting now. I don't want to disturb her.
I see. It was a rather irregular request that we received, but we did, as the note said. I just wanted to tell her that the package is being dispatched and will reach her today.
Who's calling?
Mr. Erskine. Goodbye.
Huh. Erskine. Now, from where do I know that name?
He was a mortician.
Oh, yes.
What do you want?
Oh, he said something about a package being delivered here today.
Hmm. I wonder what it is.
I don't know. Well, I'll tell Marcia about it when she wakes up.
It's strange that he didn't mention what was in it.
Well, the package will arrive today. Then we'll know what's in it. I'll get it. Hello?
This is Erskine again. I'm afraid I can't do what the note said. The thing is...
Hello? Hello? Mr. Erskine, are you still there?
What's the matter?
I don't know. He sounded like he was choking. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Marcia was still asleep. The sky was heavily overcast, and I knew that we were due for a bad storm shortly. Eric and I heard the front door chimes ring, and a few seconds later the maid ushered in a man we had seen before, the lieutenant of detectives who had been at the house after Simeon Botar had died.
What can we do for you, Lieutenant?
I don't like to trouble you, Mr. Brakely, especially today, but I'm afraid I have to.
What's the matter, Lieutenant?
Do you know Mr. Erskine?
Yes, he handled things for Marshall.
That's right. Well, he's dead.
Dead?
Yeah.
Well, he called here on the phone. He started to choke.
He choked, all right. He was strangled.
What?
That's right. And he has the same marks on his neck that Mr. Botar had that night. 5 little red marks, like the finger marks of a hand.
You are listening to the tale of The Hand of Botar on this week's journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy. We'll return to our story in just a moment. And now back to our story, entitled The Hand of Botar.
We had come back from the funeral with Marcia Jameson. She was upstairs getting some rest. A few minutes before, Lieutenant Hillman of the police had come out to the house. I learned then the reason Erskine had seemed to be choking when I talked to him on the telephone.
That's right. 5 little red marks, like the finger marks on a hand.
It's starting to rain.
Yeah, we're in for a bad storm. Erskine didn't have any enemies. He was preparing a package to send out here, and then he was killed.
Who did it?
Not who, Lieutenant. What?
How's that?
I believe it was Botar's hand that killed Erskine.
What are you talking about?
Botar's dead.
But his hand isn't.
But Simeon's been buried, Eric.
I don't care. I think it was...
That was Marcia. Come on.
Marcia! Marcia, what's the matter?
Is he up there alone?
Yes. Marcia!
I saw it. I saw it.
Saw what, Marcia?
I was half asleep.
felt that something was in the room with me. I looked up. The window was slightly ajar. And then, on the floor, I saw it creeping along.
What was it you saw?
Uncle Simeon's hand.
What?
That's right.
Let's take a look.
Are you sure? Do you know what you're saying?
Of course I do. You'll see for yourself.
Claire, it doesn't seem to be anything in here.
Maybe it went back out the window.
Lieutenant, take a look at this.
What?
Look, on the windowsill here. Little scratches as if they were made by fingernails.
You don't expect me to believe. I didn't believe it either, Lieutenant. But now I do. Botar's hand has an intelligence of its own. I believe that both Botar and Erskine were killed by that hand. I think you're crazy. And I think I can prove it to you.
How?
Lieutenant, get an order to give us permission to exhume Botar's body. Then you can see for yourself. Just a little more now.
This had better be more than a wild goose chase.
I think that's enough. We're going to open it now, Marcia.
All right.
Let's get this outside casing top off.
There you go.
To get it now. That's it. Now, let's get this casket open. There he is, Lieutenant. That's Simeon.
Look, Lieutenant.
His right hand is missing. Now, will you believe us? That thing is alive. And it's back there at the house. It's evil and malevolent. We have to go back and destroy it.
We searched the whole house and we still can't find it.
Maybe it left the house.
I don't think it has. I think it's hiding.
But where?
I don't know.
How did the hand ever get out?
When Erskine called me on the phone, he said something about an unusual request written in Simeon Botar's hand and that he was sending the package here. While he was preparing that package, the hand killed him.
That thing is somewhere in or around this house. I have a feeling that... Oh!
What was that?
Sounded like a window breaking.
Claire!
Upstairs. Let's take a look. We'll break up into two groups. Mr. McCraw and Mr. Brakely will go together. I'll keep Miss Jameson with me, all right?
All right.
Well, fine. Let's go then.
I have the only gun. If you see it,
call for
it.
All right.
Stay behind me, Miss Jameson.
I'll be right behind you.
You take the front part and we'll take the rear.
Fine.
If you see it, don't forget to call.
Let's go. Why don't we try Simeon's bedroom?
That sounds like a good idea. Come on.
Remember, that thing can hide almost anywhere.
I know. We might as well...
Look.
The bottom left pane of the French door leading to the sun porch, it's broken.
Then the hand is in here somewhere.
We can't be sure. It might have found entrance this way, but... Listen.
It's in here, all right.
Lieutenant! It's in here!
Be right there!
Eric, stand over there by the broken pane there. Make sure it can't get out.
Right.
Oh. Where is it?
Now we know it's in here somewhere. Come in quickly. Let's get that door closed.
Right.
Now, be quiet.
There it is again.
Where is it coming from?
Be quiet.
It's moving.
Can't see it. Neither can I.
Look out, Charles, in back of you. It's climbing up the wall in back of you.
Where?
And making for the light switch.
The lights are out.
Be quiet.
It's dropped down to the floor again.
I can't see a thing in the dark.
It's going after someone in this room.
Hear it moving. Be quiet.
I can feel something on my back. I can...
The hands are on her throat.
Get the hand away from her.
Right.
Hurry.
Yeah, we're doing our best.
A little bit more.
That's better. Throw it on the floor.
Shoot it. It'll get away.
Hurry, Lieutenant. Hurry. It's making for the French door.
It's horrible.
I would never have
believe this.
Nor would I.
I'm still afraid of it, even though I know it's dead.
I'll make sure that it's destroyed, once and for all.
Oh, I'll never forget the sight of it, creeping across the floor like some crawling monster.
Tonight's tale of the unusual, the terrifying, the unknown. Join us again when next we journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to hear another strange tale of the supernatural. All characters and events portrayed in these programs are fictional, and any similarity to actual events or persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
The Hand of Botar, more than a little out of control in the Hall of Fantasy. Tonight's story came from June 3, 1953, and that puts the cap on old-time radio drama for this Sunday night. I'm Norman Gilliland. Thanks for joining me. Hope you can be with me next weekend from 8 to 11 by the glow of your radio, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.